You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Democrats in the House of Representatives passed a bill last week that would restore so-called net neutrality rules, but that legislation faces an uphill battle in the Senate. We'll learn more about the bill and why net neutrality could be a platform for Democrats in 2020. Now, Milwaukee County officials proclaim that racism is a public health crisis in that community. This is building on a commitment by the Wisconsin Public Health Association to build racial equity in health and healthcare and to support efforts that are meant to achieve that goal. In the press release, Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley said, quote, "It is Milwaukee County's responsibility to address racism, including seeking solutions to reshape the discourse, actively engaging all citizens in racial justice work. Local government needs to take a leadership role, and we intend to do so," end quote. Chandra Ford is an associate professor of community health sciences and founding director of the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health in the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. She studies the impact of racism on health and the way healthcare is provided. Chandra, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, big picture, what do we know about how the health of people of color compares with that of white Americans?
In general, regardless of the health outcome that you're looking at, or the healthcare-related factor that you're considering, we tend to see that people of color, in particular African Americans and Latinos, have poorer health outcomes than do whites.
And with this proclamation from Milwaukee County saying that racism is a public health crisis, connect the dots for us. How do you see racism affecting these health outcomes you just described?
Well, over the last two decades, researchers have been studying racism quite a bit. This is an area of study that's garnered quite a bit of empirical focus over the last couple of decades. And what excites me about what's happening there in Milwaukee is this aligns very well with what the flagship Professional Society for Public Health folks has already called for. Nearly 2 years ago, the American Public Health Association recognized that racism is an issue that hampers the well-being of the entire society by sapping the resources of the entire society because a significant chunk of our population is not achieving optimal health for reasons that are preventable. What we know is that one of the main concerns that people are raising now has to do with the overt forms of racism, so things like white supremacist marches. But really, it's the day-to-day wear and tear of the disrespect, or even at the structural level, things like segregation, that has the greatest impact on the most number of people of color.
Right. I wanted to talk about the term racism. It gets used in a lot of different ways, but I think there are two that kind of talk past each other sometimes. I think popularly people think of racism as an individual thing. One person exhibits racial bias to another person. You mentioned structural racism. Can you talk about that more and how it plays out, especially with the health world?
What a great point you're making there. So when we use the term racism, we're really talking about all the structures and mechanisms by which we systematically provide poor quality services and care to one group versus another group. And when we look at the data, the groups align along racial lines. So the poor quality of care is not randomly assigned to different groups. It's pretty consistently that people of color receive poorer care or have poorer outcomes. And so that's what we're focused on. We do assess, and there is an impact of this interpersonal racism. For instance, if I'm called a name or I experience something that feels stressful or it's offensive to me, there is an impact of that. But the greater impact is, for instance, living in a segregated neighborhood. I like to use the example of if an environmental hazard is placed in a poor community, in a community of color, by definition, children who grow up in that neighborhood through no fault of their own are at increased risk of certain hazards. And at the same time, white children growing up away from that hazard, and they're growing up, by definition, if it's in the minority community, is by definition, not in the majority community, they're growing up with a certain advantage, a certain health advantage that comes from, that's actually very closely tied to the health disadvantage that the minority children will face.
Talking to Chandra Ford from the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health about the impacts of race and racism on health, healthcare, and health outcomes. And Chandra, let's start to pick apart some of these different things. You mentioned environmental factors. An issue in Milwaukee County and other communities around the country is exposure to lead, from lead paint in older buildings, lead water intakes, often in older buildings. Is this something that nationwide tends to be concentrated in places where people of color now live?
You know, an extensive assessment of exactly where all of the lead is located is really needed. But what we know so far is that children of color are overexposed to lead in paints through some of the kinds of segregation that we think of as what we might call centralization. That is, living in the center parts of cities where the infrastructure is really poor and it's really old rusted pipes, old paint, and those kinds of things where the hazards have not actually been taken care of.
And let's talk about healthcare access. What kind of differences do we see when it comes to just sheer having the ability to have a doctor's visit or a specialist visit when it comes to race?
So these are very complex because the relationship between race, ethnicity, and what we will call socioeconomic factors like income and education are really complex. Regardless of the level of education that people have, the buying power of that education is lower for blacks versus whites, for instance. And so with access to healthcare, we see a similar pattern where we already know that, based in part because of the socioeconomic patterns, that blacks and Latinos in particular and American Indians have poorer access to healthcare services in general. However, I do think it's also important to point out that even if we only looked at people who do have good access to care across race and ethnicity, that we still do see disparities occurring within the context of care. So that is something that we might be able to target within the healthcare system. How can we get providers to better recognize the ways in which the healthcare systems and individual healthcare providers might actually contribute to differential treatment that patients get?
Yeah, what might that look like on the ground in a doctor's office or clinic? What kind of differential treatment are we seeing by race in those healthcare situations?
Mm-hmm. So one example is a study conducted by one of the affiliates of my center and a colleague here at UCLA, Billy Cunningham, and his several of other physicians, where they observed that this is all among HIV patients, and they observed that those patients who were seen by white providers had differences in how long it took them to get prescribed HIV medications depending on the patient's race. Now, the same pattern did not exist for patients who were seen by black providers, black doctors. That is, patients, whether they were white or black, who were seen by a black doctor all got their HIV medications around the same point in their course of disease. But for black patients, being seen by a white provider actually predicted that they would receive their prescription to these vital medications later in the course of disease than their white counterparts.
How do you tackle that? Is this a case where we're thinking these white doctors were consciously biasing their treatment toward one patient and against another, or are there unspoken, maybe unexamined assumptions that might lead them to treat patients differently? How do we sort that out?
This is a tremendous area of interest of mine and you know, a growing area for the field. What we do know is that culture matters. Things like culture and being able to communicate effectively with one another matter, but that's not everything. there is a growing literature on implicit bias, which means that the forms of racism that are enacted are forms that the actor is actually not aware of. And what's important to keep in mind about implicit bias, and there are two points here. One is that they're not just arbitrary. It's not just that, oh, I as an individual like apples and that other individual likes oranges. The biases that we hold are actually structured by the institutions and the society that we live in, so they're shaped and they're very predictable. The other thing is that implicit bias matters a lot when we're talking about disciplines and people who are progressive identified. So it's really that it's not saying that overt racism doesn't happen, but it points out that there are people for whom implicit forms of racism are particularly salient. And those of us who believe and who really espouse equity and fairness are actually more susceptible to not knowing when we're engaging in racist acts or acts that contribute to disparities, in part because we're blinded to the ways that our own embrace of our own progressiveness can blind us to the ways that we're actually participating in creating those disparities. So one example of a possible solution might come from another recent study that looked at how having an automated system that provides cues to providers to just remember to check this patient's, each particular aspect of the care visit. The computer provides automated information for the provider. So the provider doesn't spend a lot of time trying to decide, is this a patient that should receive this treatment or not? They rely on an exchange system that can help them to be more systematic about every patient. And thus it takes away that sort of the gray area that comes into play. And that it's really taking away that gray area, that indecision, that element that involves trying to decide between X and Y for any given patient, that's where we see the big issue with bias creeping in.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about Milwaukee County declaring racism to be a public health crisis. Chandra Ford is Associate Professor of Community Health Services and Founding Director of the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as a patient or a healthcare provider. Do you see different treatments, different outcomes, different attitudes toward people of different races in that clinical setting? On a bigger picture, what do you think of how the places people live, the impacts of segregation have affected health over time? And if you have a question for our guest, call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Chandra, before we go to a caller, let's talk about solutions. As you look at a place like Milwaukee County trying to tackle this issue head on, what kind of things do you think they should start with?
You know, I think the first step has already been taken, and that is to acknowledge that there is a problem with racism. That's really just acknowledging that racism exists and that it affects us is a huge first step. And so I congratulate the folks in Milwaukee for doing that. The other thing is it's important to try to get as many diverse folks and diverse segments of the community involved in this effort. Everyone brings different perspectives to the problem. There are many ways in which racism affects folks, and unless all those different voices are heard, we won't really be able to get at the root of the problem. The National Academies in 2017 also published an extensive study in which they recommended that trying to get the buy-in even of the local private sector is important. And you can see how the involvement of the private sector might be very different from the interests of, for instance, community organizers who are concerned with what they see every day in the lives of the community members that they with whom they live and whom they love.
Let's bring on a caller now. Denise is with us in Viroqua. Denise, hi.
Hello, and thanks for having this conversation. I am white, and my husband is black. And every time we go to the doctor, he wants me to go with. And it is extremely painful and awkward experience because the doctors don't talk to him. They talk to me. And it's hard because he does not want to go to the doctor. He hates going. And all we hope is that nothing really bad happens. And I'm just so thankful that you're looking into this as a serious health issue in our community.
Denise, thanks for the call. What an experience. Chandra, is there? Do you see this problem being big enough that, as Denise is saying, someone like her husband is skeptical of the kind of care he's going to get because he's black?
That's actually not unusual at all. In a lot of my work around HIV testing and HIV care, we've found that at least 20% of African Americans may actually hold beliefs that HIV, the HIV epidemic, might be a conspiracy to try to get rid of African-American and other quote-unquote undesirable populations. One way to think about that is, oh my goodness, why do they have those extreme ideas? But the other way to think about it is these folks experience the healthcare system in a way that allows those beliefs to seem realistic and plausible. And so it's a real sign that there is something going on in the healthcare system that makes many folks feel uncomfortable. And part of it is things that have happened in the past, but still today, people, African Americans and others, experience the healthcare system in a way that makes them feel very uncomfortable trusting it.
Denise, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Tekla in Beaver Dam. Tekla, hi.
Hi, how are you? This is a great topic. My husband is a non-native English speaker, and one of the problems with the healthcare system in general is the inability to communicate effectively with people who are non-English speakers. And we have encountered a variety of issues. The best, of course, is an in-person translator. But even in that case, that translator may not be translating really what the doctor's saying. They're supposed to say word for word back and forth, but a lot of them, especially late in the afternoon, you know, are cutting it short or missing vital information. We've had some situations at certain facilities, they have signs up, if you need to speak in another language, let us know, and it's in, you know, Spanish and Hmong and China, you know, other languages, and then you request a translator and you don't get one.
Tekla, thanks for sharing that story. Chandra, is that something you've looked into, the impact of language gaps in healthcare outcomes?
Yes, that's one of the areas that researchers have examined, and those examples are just unfortunate and unfortunately actually quite common. I think this is an area where the healthcare field can really make a huge impact, and in part it might be a question of commitment. These would require dollars and investments in things like training, perhaps training providers to speak the languages, as well as investing in translators, so or in interpreters. So that's a very concrete, tangible area for improvement that could affect not only the professionalism with which care is delivered, but also the perceptions that patients walk away from the clinical encounter with.
Tekla, thanks for that call. Chandra, in our last couple minutes, can you talk to maybe administrators, healthcare providers? What kind of things should they be watching for to make sure that they get the best healthcare outcomes for their non-white patients, and to make sure that, unlike our earlier caller, that those patients feel comfortable coming in and coming to that visit?
I think one of the most important things is to actually, as researchers would say, measure it. So we get patient satisfaction surveys from our providers sometimes. Are there questions on those surveys that allow patients to talk about these kinds of experiences, not necessarily as a way to point their fingers at particular individuals, but really to show providers exactly where the kinks are in the delivery of care. I think that is a very important first step. And then I think it's also important for providers as well as white folks or other folks in majority positions to realize that in talking about racism, it's really not about the dominant group in terms of just pointing a finger. It's really about addressing the problem for the benefit of the entire community. And so I would really urge everyone to become involved in finding the solutions and not to get caught up thinking about what does this mean about me? So that's one of the concerns that I've heard expressed in some of the qualitative work that I've done. And I think that that's something that can be overcome and that it would help the full community to feel committed to this as a community-wide endeavor.
Chandra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Chandra Ford is Associate Professor of Community Health Sciences and Founding Director of the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. She joined us to talk about Milwaukee County's declaration of racism as a public health crisis. Coming up, we'll talk about the latest political fight over the rules that govern the Internet. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.